years, and a sight I will not miss," declared one man. And at that, two who had sought to leave decided to stay. Wintrow bade farewell to the others and assured them that the ship's accountant would see them paid. And Boyo said to the oldest man,
"I trust this to you, to give to Queen Etta. All of you leaving the ship here, this must not go astray."
But what he gave them was only a rather plain necklace with a dull grey charm on it. I did not understand why the crewman was so stricken with gravity. They promised him many times it would go directly to her. The boats were lowered, and we watched them row away across the waves, and we left the pirate isles behind us. That night, Captain Wintrow got very drunk, and Althea and Brashen with him. Boyo stood the night watch and commanded the ship. Clef kept him company, and Purr. They sat on the foredeck near the figurehead and sang some rude songs. The next day they all went about their work with blotched faces and shaking hands. Amber and Spark helped to fill the gaps left by the departing sailors, and the ship seemed almost to sail herself in her drive to reach the rain-wild river. I had another episode of the sickness in which I became weak and feverish. When Amber sought to reassure me that all would be well, I said that I'd been through it before and wished to be left alone. Amber seemed to find that astonishing, but acceded to my wishes. It was Purr who brought me water and soup, and when the fever had passed, begged permission of the captain that I be allowed to take a bath in his quarters. I was given a tub to stand in, a cloth to use, and a bucket of hot water. I had longed for a tub full of steaming water, but Purr explained that given Vivacia's refusal to stop in the pirate isles, we had to conserve our fresh water. With what they gave me, I could rid myself of most of my peeling skin. I emerged a colour that was a shade closer to Purr's skin, and feeling much better. It was peculiar that the very boredom of our uneventful voyage became difficult for me. After months of plotting each day how I would survive, there was suddenly very little for me to do. No one expected chores of me. Over and over I was told to rest. In those idle hours I was left to recall every detail of what had befallen me. I tried to make sense out of all that had happened. My father was dead. The people who had stolen me were dead, or mostly so. I was going home, to Buckkeep Castle, to a sister I did not know well, and a niece who was a baby. I thought of the things that had been done to me, and the things I had done to survive. Some I could scarcely believe. Biting Dwalia's face, watching Trader Acriel die, becoming the destroyer, and killing Dwalia, and setting fire to Symph and burning all the libraries. Had that truly been me? B. Farcia? I had dreams, both those full of portents and the ordinary kind. Sometimes it was hard to tell the difference. I wandered the walls of Withywoods, calling for my father, but only a wolf came to me. Trader Acriel crawled after me, screaming that it was all my fault. I tried to run from her, but my legs were jelly. A blue buck leapt into a silver lake, and a black wolf leapt out of it. A dozen dragons rose in glorious flight. Dwalia stood over my bed and laughed to think I had believed I could kill her. I dreamed of a woman who ploughed an immense field, and golden grasses grew up to be harvested into creaking wagons. I dreamed of my mother saying, "He may not seem to love you, but he does." I dreamed I watched a grand ball in an immense, festive chamber through a crack in the wall. Some I wrote down on the paper Beloved had given me, and some I kept to myself. He came to me one evening and said,
"I propose that we sit down together, and you read your dreams to me, and we discuss them."
I did not want to share them. Writing them down made them important. Reading them aloud would make them even more so. I said nothing. He sat down beside me on the foredeck. It had become my favourite place to be in the evening. His long hands, one gloved, one bared, were folded loosely in his lap.
"Please, let me know you. There is nothing more important to me than that. I want to know you and to teach you the things you must understand about yourself. Teach you about your dreams and what they might mean and what life may demand of you. Some day, you must find a catalyst and begin to make the changes."
I noticed that he did not say he wished me to know him. Amber, fool, beloved, that he was. I covered my drawing of Trader Acriel. I made a smile for him. I found a catalyst, and I made my changes. I'm finished with that. I thought of what my father would want me to do. I drew a great breath and tried not to hurt his feelings. I don't want to be a white prophet like you were.
I could wish that we could change that, but I'm afraid that for you, it's inevitable. Let's set that aside. Would you tell me about your catalyst?
He tipped his head at me and asked gently,
Is it Purr?
I tried to hide my dismay for such an idea. Purr was my friend. I already told you, my catalyst was Dwalia. She enabled me to be who I had to become the Destroyer. She changed my life. She took me from Withywoods to Clares. There I made the changes they all feared I would make, and then I killed her. I am the Destroyer, and I destroyed the Servants. He was silent for a time. His fingers, some gloved and some bared, toyed with one another.
Are you sure that Dwalia was your catalyst?
Prilcop said she was. I corrected myself. Prilcop said he thought she was.
Prilcop has been known to be wrong.
He sighed suddenly.
B, I thought this was going to be so much easier for both of us. But then, I had hoped your father might be with us, to help us become friends, to help you trust me.
But he's dead.
I know.
He suddenly sat up straight. He tilted his head to consider my face. Those eyes. I looked away. He spoke to me anyway.
B, do you blame me for his death?
No, I blame him. I hadn't known I was going to say that, but now that I had, I felt a surge of righteousness. It had been his own fault that he died, and it was fair that I was so angry with him. Beloved took my hand in his gloved one. He wasn't looking at me anymore. He stared off over the sea.
I do too, and I think I am as furious with him as you are.
I tugged my hand away, as if he were innocent. We sailed up the shifting coastline they called the Cursed Shores. Day by day we drew closer to Bingtown, until the night we could see its lights in the distance. Beloved set out plans for us. We would disembark in Bingtown, send a messenger bird to Buckkeep Castle that we needed funds for passage home, and wait to hear back from them. Althea had invited us to stay in her family home until our funds arrived and our passage was arranged, and Amber had gratefully accepted. Until our funds arrived from Buckkeep, we were paupers, dependent on her charity. The day was sunny as we sailed into Trader Bay and then Bingtown Harbour. Vivacia went directly to the docks reserved for the live ships. Our arrival caused a stir, and soon the other live ships were calling to her. It was strange to hear ships shouting to one another, demanding news. Apparently, the two small dragons that once had been Paragon had stopped in Bingtown to exhort the other ships to follow them to Kelsengra. Now they wanted to know, was it true? Had these dragons once been Paragon, the live ship? One live ship, named Kendry, was the most vocal, roaring that it was past time for ships to be free dragons. His figurehead was a handsome, bare-chested young man. He was tied at a separate dock from the other live ships, and his masts were naked of canvas. Most of the ships were curious, but Kendry's anger was frightening. It was not only the ships that were in uproar. No sooner were we tied up than a contingent of folk in peculiar robes came down the docks in a gaggle. As I disembarked behind Beloved with Spark and Purr, they were demanding permission to board. "Who are they?" I demanded as we passed them by. Men and women alike were garbed in robes of differing colours and wore grim expressions.
"They are members of the Bingtown Traders' Council,"
Beloved as Amber spoke quietly beside me.
"Each of the original families who settled here has a vote in the Bingtown Council to make decisions that bind all. The prospect of the live ships becoming dragons will upset many of them. The live ships and their ability to move up and down the rain-wild river, as well as their swiftness upon the open seas, have long given the traders a distinct advantage. Their vanishing will affect not only the families fortunate enough to have owned them for generations and to have founded their fortunes upon them, but all who have relied on them to bring first to Bingtown the finest goods from the Rain Wilds.
Boyo told me the council won't be happy about any of it,
Purr said, summing it up.
They'll likely have a big meeting tonight to decide what's to be done.
Bingtown was a place of beauty and bustle in equal measure. Folk walked with purpose in their stride. A woman loudly hailed a man, demanding to know where her shipment of fine calf leather was. Two men rose from a table and leaned forward to shake hands over a pot of tea and two cups. A messenger dashed past, her pouch of missives clutched to a bouncing bosom. Clara's had been a town of passive pastels and calm folk. Bingtown roared with colour and commerce. The scents of spices and rich meats floated on the air. Amber grinned as she strode through it and seemed familiar with the town. She was not certain of every turning, but soon found a place where we could send a messenger bird to Buckkeep Castle. Spark produced a small pouch and counted out careful coins from it to pay. As we left, Spark hefted the little bag.
Not much left of our funds, Amber.
We are fortunate to have any. Whatever we have, it must suffice, she said.
She was attired somewhere between a man's and a woman's garb. We were all in borrowed bits of clothing, for we had come aboard the Vivacia with only the clothes in which we had gone overboard. In comparison with the smartly clothed traders and the colourfully garbed folk on the streets, we looked like beggars. We were on our way back to the ship when Spark shrieked and bolted away from us. I looked up to see a man charging toward her. He seized Spark around the waist and hugged her tight, then spun her around. I was groping for my belt knife when Purr shouted,
Lant! How can it be? Lant!
And it was. He was baked brown from the sun and more ragged than any of us. But it was Lant, indeed. His restoration was enough to decree that we would spend what little coin we had to share a small meal. We sat at a table outside a tea-house under a canopy. Lant supplemented our coins with his.
I was clinging to wreckage when the sea rose past me, fleeing the harbour. Her crew threw me a line, and I clung to it until they drew me aboard. I begged them to take me back, but neither mate nor crew would hear of that. I'd landed in the middle of a mutiny, for they'd left their insane captain behind them in Clara's.
It was a fine tale as he told it. He had worked aboard her as a common sailor, and when she put into port, he had left her and taken passage on a vessel bound for the Spice Isles. From there, he had found work on a little boat happily bound for Bingtown. He had arrived within a day of Vivacia and quickly come to find us. I tried to be glad for Spark and Purr, but their joyous reunion made me want to weep. Beloved wore Amber's smile, but in a chance moment I saw melancholy in his eyes. They bought drinks squeezed from fruit and seasoned with a tingling spice. When it came time to pay, the tea woman refused our money. She touched the wooden earring she wore and said,
They brought me more luck than ever I could have imagined. I am glad to see you back in Bingtown, Amber, and look forward to seeing your shingle once more swinging on Rain Wild Street.
We were on our way back to the ship, only to be met by Althea, before we reached the harbour. She grinned to see Lant with us.
I see you found them. Come, I will take you to my family home.
Her invitation was more of an order than a request. As we fell in with her, she led us up cobbled streets toward a section of the town where gracious homes gazed serenely over garden walls festooned with fragrantly blooming vines. When we had left the crowds of the city behind us, she spoke hastily.
We go to fetch my mother. The mood of the Traders' Council is a testy one. They assailed us for the Vestrit vote, urging us to forbid other traders from allowing silver to be given to the liveships. My mother controls that vote. They were very bitter with Brashen and me, accusing us of failing our duties as traders when we allowed Paragon to become dragons.
As if you could have stopped him, Purr injected.
Worse, as if we should have stopped him. Paragon was right. Once we knew it was possible, both Brashen and I knew it was the correct choice for him, no matter how hard it was for us.
So you will argue that the ships should be allowed to seek the silver and become dragons?
No,
Althea replied grimly. For a short woman, she moved rapidly, her speed making up for the shortness of her stride.
Brashen and I will not attend the council meeting at all, nor Wintrow. This way.
She turned aside from the shady thoroughfare onto a carriageway. A short distance down it
we encountered a stout wall of worked stone. But no gate barred our passage, and we entered a type of garden I had never seen before. Flat, grassy areas spread out to either side, as if sheep had grazed them to an even height, but left no dung. There were tall trees, and beneath them, shady banks of flowers. This vista stretched out beyond us in all directions. To one side, I saw a little building with its walls made of glass. Inside, plants pressed up against the glass like children peering out. We walked and walked, and Althea muttered,
"I should have sent a runner for a carriage. I was too angry to think."
"The grounds are exceptionally beautiful this year," Amber observed, winning a wry smile from Althea.
"Money buys good servants. But yes, they are exceptionally lovely. Nothing like the storm-battered neglect you saw the first time you visited."
She shook her head.
"I wonder if we will be able to keep the grounds like this with Barragon gone. Well..."
The last word came out on a harsh exhalation of breath, and she bounded up the wide front steps. Without a pause, she opened the door and entered, calling out,
"Mother, we're in port, and we've important news."
Two servants in matching livery were hastening toward us, but Althea waved them off with,
"We're fine. Reynolds, good to see you. Anger, where is my mother?"
We heard a questioning, "Althea, is that you?" from down the passage, and then a door opened. Stick in hand, a grey-haired woman emerged. The hand that clutched the stick had knotted knuckles, and her face was lined, but the woman stepped briskly as she came toward us with a smile.
"And who have you brought home with you this time? Wait, Amber, is that you after all these years?"
"It is,"
Amber replied, and the woman's eyes and smile widened.
"Come in, come in. I just requested tea and a bite. Reynolds, can you please bring enough for a horde? You know how Althea eats when she first gets home."
Reynolds, who had been hovering, responded with a grin.
"Indeed, yes, ma'am. Right away."
Althea introduced the rest of us, but as she began to explain, her mother said,
"I know more than you think I do, and far less than I should like to. I received your dispatches from Divitown and was frankly terrified for you and Brashen and Boyle. But Carrick Vestrit assured me that you had survived and that Vivacia would bear you home. How badly injured is Boyle?"
"Carrick Vestrit?"
Althea was shocked.
"The blue one. The green dragon was more guarded about her name. She is the decidedly odd one, and I think the most responsible for Paragon's uneven nature when he was a ship. How is Boyle?"
"The dragons came here and spoke to you."
"Would you like to see the mess they made of the Iris Gardens around the reflecting pool? That is where the two bullocks they requested fled to, and where they feasted. So I knew you were alive, and I hoped you were coming directly home. But I know little more than that, and understand still less of it."
"Well, that saves me some time, but there is much more to tell, and an even more immediate worry. A contingent from the Traders' Council met us as soon as we docked. They were very angry that Paragon had become dragons. They all but accused us of treason. And now Vivacia wishes..."
"Trader business is for traders,"
her mother rebuked her firmly. She turned a smile on us.
"Please, I do not even know your names yet, but please be comfortable here while Althea and I converse privately. In here, if you would."
In here was a spacious room with cushioned chairs near windows that looked over the spoiled iris garden. The room was floored with white tiles, and a table with a white-tiled top was surrounded by six chairs. As Amber ushered us in, I heard the mother say,
"Oh, excellent. Reynolds, in there, and please... a word with you afterward."
"Did we offend her?" Lant asked in a quiet voice, but Amber shook her head.
"Not at all. Traders are very private about their business. I am sure she will join us shortly. Oh, my, hot tea and lemon."
Reynolds entered with a large silver tray bearing a steaming china pot and cups. As he set it down, I smelled tea and saw a sliced yellow fruit in a little dish on the tray. Two other servants followed, carrying similar trays of little cakes and cold sliced meats and tiny bread rolls.
"Real food," I said aloud, and Purr laughed.
"Like Withywood's food,"
he affirmed. I felt awkward and shy, but Amber was not. She seated herself and dismissed Reynolds with a nod after he had poured cups of tea for each of us. My teacup had a painting of a rose on it and a delicate little handle. The tea was dark and strong. I copied Amber, squeezing juice from the lemon into the tea. Tea had always both calmed me and cleared my mind. Lant put little cakes on a small plate and set them in front of me. I looked at them, and my throat went tight as I recalled a winter feast that had never been. Purr bit into one that was dusted with cinnamon. I took one and broke it. It was pink all through it. I tasted it, and it was strawberry, like my mother had grown. I hid my tears as I ate it. The tea smelled like the kitchen at Withywood's in the morning. It was hard to swallow it. Amber was speaking to the others.
Funds from Igrod's hoard. I believe Althea put a goodly amount of her share into restoring her childhood home, for it had been neglected due to lack of funds even before the mercenaries invaded and vandalized half the town. I know she fears for their fortune with the live ship gone, but I am sure that Paragon was not Ronica's only business investment. I am confident that Althea and Brashen and Ronica can generate income with any ship, even if it does not speak to them.
Would you like more? You've hardly eaten. Lant asked me quietly. I was surprised at the concern in his eyes. Then I realized that my father's absence would be sharply real to him this day. I don't know, I said, and he nodded gravely. Purr was still eating. Amber and Spark had risen from the table and taken their cups to the windows to look out over the destruction. There was a tap at the door, and Reynolds entered. He looked a bit uncomfortable as he said,
"If it please you, Tred Vestrit noticed that the child is shoeless. There are children among the servants who have outgrown shoes and skirts, and she thought I might offer something to you for her."
He spoke to Lant and Amber as if I were too young to understand him. I spoke for myself. I would be very grateful indeed for anything that might cover my feet. I was the most ragged among us, for while the others had been given clothing from Vivacia's crew, nothing they had would fit me. Reynolds had brought several pairs of the soft leather slippers that house servants usually wore, and one set with a harder sole. Fortunately, that was the pair that fit me the best. I donned the skirt over the ragged cotton trousers that Capra had given me to wear. The skirt tied with a sash and looked much too tidy to be worn with my stained blouse. It had been so long since I'd worn skirts that it felt strange. I thanked Reynolds for his thoughtfulness, but Purr shook his head. As Reynolds was leaving, he marveled sadly,
"A princess of the six duchies wearing a servant's hand-me-downs."
"A princess?"
Ronica asked as she came in the door. She smiled as she said it, as if it were a fancy of mine.
"That's not quite her correct title," Amber said, "but a high-born lady."
"One who is very glad of shoes," I put in, lest Althea's mother think me ungrateful. I curtsied to her in my new skirts and said, "Thank you so much for your thoughtfulness."
"She is the daughter of Fitzchivalry Farseer. B, the girl we went to rescue,"
Althea filled in. Her mother jerked her gaze to her daughter.
"She is the daughter of the Farseer prince who healed Fron?"
She looked stricken.
"I did not understand. I grieved when Althea told me that he had died. He was your father? Oh, I am so sorry. Our family owes him a debt we can never repay."
"And it doubled when she healed Boyo of his burns from when the Clarys folk set fire to Paragon. Mother, we thought he would lose the use of that arm and be forever scarred, but his new skin is pink and healthy."
"Boyo was that badly burned? Obviously there is a great deal to your tale that you have not told yet."
"There is, and precious little time to stand here and tell it. Mother, we must get back to the ship. May we use the carriage?"
"Of course. Just let me change my shoes. Reynolds, the carriage, please, as quickly as possible. Althea, come with me while I change. I have many questions for you."
And they hastened off. A short time later, a behatted Ronica escorted all of us to the carriage. Purr and Lant had not left a crumb or a drop of tea on the table. I'd almost forgotten how to manage skirts, and I stepped on my hem, climbing up into the very grand carriage. Purr had only a moment to gape at the matched black horses that would take us back to the docks, and then the door was latched behind us, and we were on our way. As we rattled over the cobblestone streets, Ronica Vestrit leaned across to take my hands in hers.
"Had we time, my dear, there would be a feast in your honour, and I would see you decked out as befits not your station, but your kindness. I have only 2 grandchildren, and your family has saved them both. I regret that our visit will be so short, and I grieve at your loss. I am saddened that you must be on your way again tonight."
"What is this?" Amber interjected. Althea spoke tersely.
"I've sent a bird down to the harbour. Windrow and Brashen will have seen to replenishing our water and bringing on as many supplies as time allows. As soon as a traders' council meeting is convened, we will be departing Bingtown Harbour and heading for Treehog. We've sent a bird ahead to Kelsingra to demand for Vivacia what should be hers by right, enough silver for her to become a dragon."
"But," Amber attempted,
"I should have told you first that my mother has received bird messages from Malta and Rain. Bookkeep has already sent magic users to Gelsingra. Some were overcome by the voices of the city and could not stay long, but others could keep their walls, as they put it, and they helped many people there. When they went across the river to the village, they could do even more, away from the stones of the city."
Ronica Vestrit was smiling as she spoke.
"Including Rain's sister," she added, "and we have sent our bird to let Kelsingra know that we will be bringing you back up the river to them. Your book magic users have some method of travelling between the 6 duchies and Kelsingra using magic statues, as I understand it, and perhaps they will be able to take you home that way."
"They could," Amber said quietly. I could tell she was startled by this news.
"And very quickly indeed." She took my hand. "It may be a bit frightening, but it would cut many days from our journey."
"I've travelled through a stone before," I reminded her, as I disengaged my hand from hers. I fell silent, thinking of being trapped with the others in the ruins of Chaelsed, of Repin falling back into the stone. The coach battled us along.
Chapter 44. Up the River.
A disappointing night. I slipped from my room and went very quietly to my father's study. Last night, I had taken some of his writings from his desk. In them, I read of a day he spent with my mother, when they were very young. He wrote of reading to her something her mother had written for her, a recipe for candles. So strange to read such sentimental words from the pen of one who holds himself on such a tight rein. And he wrote something there that I had never known. On the night she summoned him to tell him that I would be born, when he followed her to the room where I would come out of her body, those were the candles she burned. How could he not have told me such a thing? Was he saving it until I was older? Does it still exist, that precious writing of my grandmother's? I put his pages back with the edges uneven, exactly as he had left them. Tonight, when I heard him finally go to his bed, I went again to his study. I wanted to read again how tenderly he thought of her, how astounded he was on the night I was born, and how certain he had been that I would not live. But the pages were not where he had left them, and when I stirred the dying fire on the sturdy hearth, that I might have a bit more light to look for them, I saw their fate. I saw the words I recalled from the last page. "I will ever regret," curling on the page as the flames ate them. I watched them go, watched them forever lost to me. Why, I wonder, does he write and then burn? Does he seek to banish his memories? Does he fear that writing it down makes it important? Someday I hope to sit next to him and demand that he tell to me everything he can remember of his life, and I will write it down and never let the flames steal it.
B. Farseer's Journal.
We reboarded Vivacia, but she felt like a different ship. Althea, Brashen, and Boyo were aboard, but Paragon's crew members had disembarked. From overheard conversations, I knew that Brashen had seen that they had funds for their immediate needs and promised them that they would be paid their full wages in the next 2 days and given recommendations for future work. For some of them, it had been years since they had lived ashore. Paragon had been their home, and most were already pounding the docks looking for a new berth on another ship. "Why must we leave so soon?" Lant asked Boyo. We had herded ourselves into the galley to avoid being in the way, and Boyo had come in to give me a parcel that had been delivered to the ship. It had my name on it. It was wrapped in canvas and tied with string. The knots were complicated, but I didn't want to cut the string.
"It's a trader thing. If we are underway before the council votes that the live ships must not be allowed to turn into dragons, then we don't know they voted that, so we aren't disobeying the Traders' Council. That's something no Bingtown trader wants to be accused of, let alone found guilty of and fined. The Alliance of Bingtown Traders has become extremely important since the impervious ships started competing for the river trade. If all the live ships go dragon, the Bingtown traders won't have any way of bringing articles from Treehog and Kelsingra and the other little Rainwild towns to Bingtown, unless they hire impervious ships. The Rainwild traders will have to start doing business with the impervious boats, and we lose our monopoly on Elderling goods. So we leave tonight, and we run hard for Treehog, and we hope that Malta and Rain agree with us and get the silver shipped down to Treehog as fast as possible."
He gestured with his pink hand, palm up.
"Once it's on its way, it's a done deal, and to be honourable traders, we have to accept shipment of it."
"Can they really stop the live ships from turning into dragons?" asked Purr.
"Probably not, but those who don't own live ships, those who think they are just talking boats, believe they can order us to do that, and they could make it difficult for us."
"Aren't they just talking boats?" asked Purr innocently.
"No, they're family,"
Boyo replied seriously, and then realized Purr was teasing him. I got the knot undone and pulled the string away. I unfolded canvas to find trousers and a jerkin. The material was like silk and patterned with golden frogs on a background of green lily pads. They were as colourful as the butterfly cloak had been. I ran the fabric over my hands. It snagged slightly on my broken nails and rough skin.
"They're beautiful. I will set them aside for when I grow into them. Who should I thank?"
Boyo was staring at the gift, open-mouthed.
"My grandmother," he said breathlessly. "And you don't have to wait to wear them. They're elderling made. They'll adjust."
"Will they make her invisible?"
Purr asked.
"What?"
"She had a cloak like that, with butterflies on it, and it made the wearer invisible."
Boyo stared. "You meant really invisible when you told me that story? You never actually showed us how it worked that night when Fitz chased us out of Amber's cabin, the night Kennetson and I glimpsed the silver."
For a moment, he went still, recalling his friend. Then he shook his head.
"I thought you meant she had covered you with the cloak and thrown snow over the cloak to make you invisible."
He sat back.
"Do you still have it? Can I see it?"
As Purr shook his head, we heard a shout.
"Boyo! On deck!"
It was his father, and he jumped to his feet.
"And no, they won't make her invisible, but they are worth a small fortune. Try them on!"
And he clattered away to his father's command. That very night, we were underway again. Vivacious mooring lines were slipped, and we ignored the shouts of the harbour master's underlings. We sailed under a clear sky, and when the moon rose and I went out on deck, I saw we were not alone. Kendry trailed us.
"Well, I'm glad his family isn't going to fight him anymore,"
Brashen said when he came to stand beside me. He looked down at my beautiful clothes and smiled.
"Aren't you fine?"
But as Boyo dashed by behind us, he dared to tousle my hair.
"For good luck,"
he whispered, and then ran on. More sail blossomed on Vivacia's masts, and we easily outpaced Kendry. Up the coast we fled, with Purr and Ant keeping watch in the crow's nest for any pursuit. They saw two ships, but they could catch neither Vivacia nor Kendry. and when we started up the river, Brashen laughed and said the acid would protect us from any pursuit. We sailed against the current. I watched how it was done and marvelled at it, and marvelled, too, at a landscape I could never have imagined. In the evenings, our little company gathered at the table. It began with Per telling me of their journey from Kelsingra down the river, and gradually other stories of their travel were shared. Lant spoke of how Per had killed Elik, a different tale from the one Per had told. Lant's praise made him blush. We recalled those who had died at Withywoods. Spark wept when Per spoke of how his mother had forgotten him. Boyo remembered Paragon to us, and more than once tears were shed for the ship turned dragons. I heard stories of Malta, whom I would meet, and her romance with a veiled, rain-wild trader, and how they had wed after many adventures. In my hesitant turn, I began to tell how Shun and I had been taken, of Elik, of Vindalaya's magic, of the Chael Sedian. I even told them of Trader Acriel and her death. But of killing Dwalia and Simph, I said not a word. Silent, too, was beloved Amber. I wanted to hear what that person knew of my father, of the years he said they had shared. But he gave me none of that. Such a strange riverscape. I saw bright-colored birds and, once, a troop of shrieking monkeys fleeing through the trees. No one asked me to do hard work. No one struck me or threatened me. I had no reason to be afraid. Yet I would wake as often as 4 times a night, shaking and weeping, or so paralyzed by fear that I could not even cry out.
"Come with me,"
someone said one night, standing by my hammock in the shifting dark, and I cried out in alarm, for I thought it was Vindalaya commanding me again. But it was Beloved. I followed him up to the foredeck near the figurehead, but not on the special little deck where her family often gathered to speak to her. Vivatia was both anchored and tethered for the night, for the changing currents of the river made night navigation dangerous. I dreaded long discussion with him. Instead, he took out a little flute.
"A gift from Wintro," he said, and began to play soft and breathy music on it.
When it was over, he handed me his little wooden pipe and said,
"Here are where your fingers go. If it sounds wrong, your fingers aren't blocking the holes completely. Try each note."
It was both harder and easier than it looked. By the time the sun was threading through the trees, I could sound each note clearly. I ate with everyone, and then found a place on top of the aft house to curl up out of the way and sleep. I felt like a cat, sleeping in warm sunlight while everyone around me worked. In my sleep, Vivatia spoke to me.
"It's like poison working out of a wound. Let the tears fall, and let the fear shake you. On my deck or within my hold, you do not have to be strong. Let go of what you had to hide."
Before we reached Treehog, I could play 4 simple tunes, and sleep at night in the dark. The ship helped me twice to meet with Boyo secretly. He did not ask me. Vivatia was the one who told me that something was binding in his elbow, and he could not straighten his arm completely. He worked alongside the others and did not complain, but he could not swing through the rigging as he once had. She woke me by night, and I went to him as he stood the anchor watch. I moved very softly, and he startled when I reached to take his hand in mine.
"Don't tell,"
I whispered, and he stared at me in shock and dismay. He tried to pull his hand away, but I held him fast, and then he felt what I did.
"The ship says it's like loosening a line jammed in a block and tackle,"
I told him as I worked.
"How can I thank you?"
he asked me as he flexed his arm.
"By not telling anyone,"
I said, and slipped away to my hammock. But the next day he took me up in the rigging with him, to the very top, and showed me the river and the jungle. And while he named the birds and the trees we could see, I put right a place where the skin on his neck had healed as smooth and shiny as polished wood.
"It pulls sometimes,"
was all he needed to say, and then we clambered down, and no one was the wiser, save he and I. I had looked forward to Treehog after all Per had told me of it. He shouted to me at his first sight of one of the little houses dangling in the trees. He stood beside me, and we pointed and exclaimed as we saw little children running along outstretched branches and a man fishing from a tree branch over the river. So I was disappointed when our crew anchored Vivacia out of the channel but in the river, away from the docks. Another live ship, a flat black barge named Tarman, was waiting for us, and we anchored next to him. Lines were exchanged to raft the two ships together. Three little boats from the treehouse town rowed out to us, but Captain Wintrow denied them permission to come aboard or tie to us.
"We are concluding a bargain," he warned them.
Trader custom meant they could not come aboard or speak to us. I stood at the railing and watched, wishing I were more a part of it, regretting what I had not learned and done. Vivacia reached for me, and I lowered my walls. She suffused me with reassurance and a wave of warm gratitude for what had been done for Boyo and his cousin, Fron.
"What you have done, no one else could," she assured me.
The people on Tarman's deck shouted greetings, and Per seized my hand and begged immediately to be allowed to cross to the other ship. Althea said we might, and my heart leapt with a good sort of fear as we crossed over the gap between the two ships and onto Tarman. Had Vivacia spoken to him somehow? He welcomed me, and he felt like a gracious old gentleman as he reassured me that I was safe on his decks. The captain of Tarman saw me touching his railing, and as he hurried by me, he muttered,
"I should have guessed that would happen."
On both vessels, the work was swift and frantic. Vivacia's remaining boat was moved and tied off to Tarman. Up from the hold and out of the captain's stateroom came everything of value or sentiment. Charts and chairs, glasses and bedding, all manner of things came across the gap and were stowed in Tarman's hold. At the same time, heavy casks were hauled up from Tarman's hold and arranged in a row on his deck. Captain Leftrin and his red-haired wife were much too busy to meet anyone new. He told Per to put me up on the flat roof of the deckhouse. He did, and then Per darted away to be helpful. I felt strange to be the only one idle, but from that perch I could hear snatches of conversations. Several of the crew on Tarman joked with Spark and Per that they had feared the casks would leak.
"We'd be trying to sleep, wondering if we'd wake up in a dragon's belly instead of inside Tarman,"
one man called out to Lant. He was greeted with a chorus of shushes.
"Sound curries across the water,"
a plump woman warned him, and he grinned and fell silent. Midway through the day, Kendry anchored alongside us.
"Not sure we have enough,"
Brashen called to his captain in a low voice.
"We'll take whatever you can spare,"
the captain replied. He shook his head. He was an older man, older than my father had been, and his face was lined. His eyes were the same as Brashen's had been when he knelt by Boyo and looked at his burns. His voice was thick with sorrow.
"He's been in agony for years now. Time to release him."
Evidently, Kendry had not been sailed for a time, for there was much less to unload from him. As they loaded their few goods onto Tarman, his captain spoke to his sparse crew, thanking them for bringing the difficult ship up the river. He grimly wished them good fortune in finding work again. It was Captain Leftrin who gruffly noted that the dragon traders had two impervious ships that could use experienced river crew.
"I'd almost forgotten that Kelsingra had a couple of those,"
Kendry's captain replied speculatively.
"They haven't been used much since we captured them. Tarman's better on the river, shallow draft and all. But when his turn comes..."
They both fell silent. Kendry's captain nodded grimly, and Captain Leftrin added,
"We'll have a surplus of captains for a time, but experienced crew is always welcome."
"So, Tarman will change too?"
"He's not decided yet. At present, he's our lifeline. But if we get the impervious ships crewed, well..."
Captain Leftrin stroked the railing of his barge as if he were ruffling a boy's hair.
"He is the one who must decide,"
he finished.
"Leftrin, we're ready,"
Wintrow said. It still took some time. The day was fine and the wind blew the sweet fragrance of flowers across the water as the crew said their farewells to Vivacia. there were tears. Some of the crew had been aboard her for most of their lives. And then there was a shifting of lines and anchor chains, both to bring the figurehead alongside Tarman's deck, and to make it possible to salvage the chain and anchors afterward. Traders, I saw, wasted very little. If there had been any more time, I think they would have taken every scrap of canvas and line off her, but there was a limit to what Tarman could hold. On Kendry's decks, his crew waited uncertainly. The figurehead had his arms crossed over his manly chest, muscles bulging with tension. He was scowling as he looked about. Then his gaze met mine. He hunched his shoulders as if embarrassed and tried for a smile. It was more frightening than his scowl had been. My friends joined me on top of the deckhouse. Tarman's decks filled with Vivacia's crew. Amber was weeping. I didn't know why. Vivacia's figurehead picked a cask from our deck. In her hands, it was like a very large mug. She studied it, and then, with an incredible strength, she broke the top with her thumb, raised it, and began to drink. Her colours brightened as if she had been freshly painted. Everywhere that she had been built from wizardwood, varnish and paint flaked away. Planks and railings shone with an unusual sheen. A second keg. A third. It did not take that much for Paragon, Per said.
He was desperate, Boyo said. He had to change or die. I think that's why his dragons were so small. He became as much as he could with that small amount of silver.
Hephaestia was reaching for another cask. She caught my eye and winked at me. I glanced away. That was six casks. I could feel Kendry's tension shimmering across to me. Almost half the casks were gone. With every cask she drank, she changed slightly. Her face was not so human as it had been. Her wizardwood planks were scaled now. She chose another keg. As she began to drink it, I heard a popping, crackling noise. She dropped the empty cask into the river and gave a shudder, like a horse with a fly on her withers.
Where?
Shouted Captain Leftrin. But there was nowhere to flee, as Vivacia's mast fell like a cut tree. Only good fortune put most of it on the far side of her hull. Spars, lines, rigging came down like a wind-toppled tree. I crouched, my arms over my head, but the bulk of it missed us. The fallen mast and spars dragged the canvas away from us as the river's current tried to carry it off. For a few moments, all was frantic activity as sailors cleared fallen lines from Tarman's railing. There was shouting, the thud of hatchets cutting lines, and a lurching as the debris of the ship tugged at Tarman. I looked for Vivacia. I saw only wreckage churning in the river's current. Then it was floating away down the river, a sloppy raft of wood and canvas. For a moment, Vivacia's aft house was floating among it, and then it began to slowly sink deeper and deeper.
"Oh, that's going to be a hazard in the channel,"
someone said. But I wasn't staring at that. Wallowing among some of the loose wreckage was a large silver dragon. She was twice the size of Paragon's dragons.
"Will she drown?"
Althea cried out in a low, agonized voice. For the dragon was sinking. Her large head with its glittering blue eyes lingered a moment on the surface and then sank out of sight. Althea screamed, her hands reaching uselessly toward the water.
"Wait!"
cried Brashen. I held my breath. I could feel the dragon struggling beneath the water. She fought the current, then let it catch her. It carried her downstream. I turned my head that way, and suddenly, in a shallower part of the channel, I saw the water stirring, and then there was a wild splashing. "There!" I shouted and pointed. A head, a long neck, a spiny back, and then, with a tremendous surge of effort, the silver dragon leapt into the air. Her wide wings spread, scattering water not in droplets, but as bucket loads. She beat her wings, and for a moment I feared she would fall back into the river. But with every heavy stroke, she rose a little higher. A long tail followed her out of the water.
"She's flying!"
Althea cried, and her joy and the wave of joy I felt from the rising dragon were one.
I'm so proud of you!
Boyo shouted at her. Everyone on the deck laughed, and the dragon trumpeted uncertainly.
I cannot reach it!
Kendry cried out, and his roar of despair was equal to Vivacia's joyful trumpeting. He was listing as his figurehead strained to reach for the remaining kegs on Tarman's decks.
Move those kegs!
Leftrin ordered, and all on deck sprang to his order.
Quickly!
He added, and I felt Tarman's uneasiness as Kendry leaned on him. It made his deck cant down, and a keg got away from a sailor, rolled across the deck, and cracked sharply against the bulwark. Kendry seized it, and it trickled silver onto Tarman's deck as he raised it to his mouth.
Oh, sweet sir!
Captain Leftrin exclaimed, but the silver soaked into Tarman as if his deck were a sponge, leaving not a trace. I felt a little shiver of pleasure run through him, but no more than that. The other kegs were being transported more carefully, and as Kendry came upright, our deck didn't slope. On the shore, people were shouting and pointing at Vivacia's dragon as she tested her wings above the river. Kendry was on his fourth cask when a small vessel from Treehog came alongside Tarman.
Catch a line!
The man in the bow shouted. No one did. A small red-faced woman with a thicket of dark curly hair stood up in the middle of the boat.
Last night at the agreed-upon hour, a vote was taken. What you are doing is forbidden by a vote of the Bingtown Council. Their prohibition has been affirmed and duplicated by the Rain Wild Traders Council. You must cease immediately.
What's that?
Leftrin shouted back at them.
Can you say that again?
For as they spoke, a long silver dragon swept over us, trumpeting her joy.
Stop that immediately!
Stop what?
Her rowers were working hard to stay in place along the Tarman. It seemed as if each time they were almost close enough to catch hold of one of his anchor lines, our ship would sidle slightly away from them. She who had been Vivacia continued to sweep over us in circles that made us all duck from the wind of her wings and push the councilwoman's small boat about as if it were a toy. By the time she shouted out at us that we must not aid any ship in turning into a dragon, Kendry finished the last cask and tossed it casually into the air. Chance made it land with a splash beside the small boat, and the woman shouted in alarm and was barely caught by one of her rowers before she went over. Captain Leftrin shook his head and made a mocking face.
Even a child would know better than to stand up in the middle of a rowboat. You will be condemned for this!
The woman shouted as her rowers pulled their oars and bore her away from us.
You will be fined for contempt of a lawful council ruling.
No one was paying attention. Kendry, it turned out, was a very gaudy dragon, with stripes and spots of orange, pink and red on a black hide. His eyes were jade green. He was smaller than Vivacia, and as he rose into the sky, he trilled rather than roared. He joined Vivacia over our heads. They sparred twice there above us, and then both swiftly flew upriver. Captain Leftrin looked around his deck at his surplus of crew.
Time to go, he announced. Get those anchors up. Tarman wants to head for home.
He's done something to himself,
Captain Leftrin muttered to Elise. Elise had been showing me that some sailor knots were the same ones my mother had used to crochet. We were sitting around the galley table when he came in out of the rain. He dripped across to the little galley stove and made it hiss with rain spatter from his oilskins as he poured himself a mug of coffee.
Done something?
Elise asked worriedly. He shook his head.
We're making good time,
he abruptly announced to all of us.
Excellent time.
He looked at her and added,
better time than we've ever made since I've been captain.
And then he stumped back out onto the rainy deck. I must have looked worried.
Oh, don't fret, dear,
Elise assured me.
The ship is having a bit of a joke. They'll sort it out, I'm sure.
But Tarman's good time, as we went up the river, seemed slow indeed to me. I learned three more tunes on the pipe. Spark and Purr insisted I learn more knots. I surprised them with crochet. I could not manage the big lines on the ship. My hands were too small, and I lacked the strength. But with very thin cord, Elise and I made table mats. I spent a great deal of time with her in the galley, helping to make the meals, and in her stateroom, listening to her stories of her girlhood in Bingtown. When we walked together on the deck, Captain Leftrin often watched us with a wistful expression. At night, when the weather was fine, we slept on top of the deckhouse and looked up at the stars in the black sky. Once, when we had tied up to a sandy bank for the night, I went with Amber to find some tall reeds that were like cattails, but different. She cut a dozen, brought them back aboard, and made several whistles from them, and Purr joined me in learning to play. Their sound was not as fine as her wooden pipe, but we enjoyed them. Often we were banished to the stern of the barge while we practiced. I had other lessons with Beloved, in the small cabin Spark and I shared with him. Beloved spoke of dreams, and changes to my skin, of responsibility to the world, and to my own conscience. He told me tales of other white prophets and how they had changed the world, sometimes with very small deeds. Despite myself, I enjoyed the stories. It was confusing. I was starting to like him, despite how I nursed my anger at him when I missed my father late at night. His lessons cautioned me that great events often hinged on small ones.
Your father was the unexpected son. When I was young and dreamed of him, I saw always that the chances of him surviving boyhood were very small, let alone his chance of living through manhood. And so I came all the way from Clarys, wending my way to Buckkeep Castle to put myself in service to King Shrewd and wait and hope that I was right. The first time I saw him, he did not see me. He was just a little boy, trudging along behind the stern stable master. I looked down on them from my window in the tower, and I knew him in that moment. And later that day, when a cart driver thought to harass him, the boy stood him off without a word. Oh, B, I put him through so much. It was not a kindness for me to find him and demand that he live through all sorts of beatings and abuse. Time after time, I pulled him back from death's door. He endured pain and privation, hardship and heartbreak, much loneliness. But he changed the world. He made dragons real again.
That was the day he put his face down in his hands, one gloved and one bare, and wept. After a time, I stood up and left him there. I had no more comfort for him than he did for me. When we docked in Kelsengrar, it was so easy that Captain Leftrin was left cursing with amazement. We arrived in the middle of a sunny morning, and the sky was full of dragons. Paragon's dragons were there, already larger than when we had last seen them, and Vivacia and Kendry, as well as the red dragon from Clarys, and the great blue one called Tintaglia. I saw no sign of the immense black dragon that had helped to flatten the castle. The city itself had more buildings, and larger ones than ever I had seen, even larger than Soulsby.
That's because the city was built for the dragons as much as for the elderlings, Purr told me. Look at the steps, how wide they are, and the height of the doors on that building.
He had already recounted so many wonders that I would soon see that I could hardly bear to wait for the time it took to secure Tarman to the dock. I jumped when Lant suddenly shouted right beside me,
Hoy! Clancy! By Ida and El! Marden! Nick! Look at them! They're here! They're here in Kelsengrar!
He was literally hopping up and down with excitement, and it was a few moments before I could wring from him that the folk on the dock were from Buckkeep Castle, the Queen's own coterie, my sister Nettle's special skill users. Spark had never met them, while Purr was as ignorant as I was. There were three of the Buck folk, and they looked almost like a different kind of human, with their short stature, dark skin and dark curling hair, beside the tall, slender elderlings, with skin and scales in every imaginable colour and pattern.
"They've come to take us home," Amber said softly.
She put an arm around me and a hand on my shoulder. I tolerated it. I thought of that word as the ropes were tied and a walkway put down for us. Home. It would not be